Hi, everybody. My name's Betty, and I'm an alcoholic. By hook or crook, I am speaking this afternoon. I want to thank Ted, and I want to say I believe he's one of the most unflappable people I've ever met, because no matter what I've told him on the telephone, it was just fine. I have a little problem. I fell the other day for the first time in years, and so I'm not 100%, but anyway, I am happy to be here and share with you. I came into this program March the 13th of 1979. It was through the grace of God and the loving concern of you people in this fellowship. I'm so grateful. I think of that date as the day I started to become recycled. Besides being in AA, I have all the qualifications and am an Al-Anon. I could have been an Al-Ateen had I known about it at the time. So if you want to look at it that way, I'm a triple winner in my own family group. I want to say that I go to Al-Anon some of the time. AA has to be my priority, of course. But I get a lot of good things from Al-Anon, and I don't want to ever give it up. I always feel like if anyone is critical of Al-Anon, it is simply because of ignorance. They do not know better. They do not understand the beautiful program of Al-Anon. And having said that, I'm going to tell you a joke. And it was told to me by an Al-Anon who shall remain nameless. And one day he said to me, "Betty, do you know why Al-Anons always close their eyes when they make love?" And I said, "Well, no, why would Al-Anons always close their eyes when they make love?" And he says, "Because they just can't stand to see an alcoholic having a good time." Well, I am a miracle, and that is my favorite slogan. Expect a miracle. I am one, and I knew that I was one who couldn't get it because I was so different. Well, this is a different talk than I've ever given, and I hope it'll be all right. I feel like I'm among friends, and I feel that if my talk isn't all right, that you will, with the breath of kindness, blow my imperfections away. I think you will. In the first place, when I found out I was an alcoholic, I knew it before I came in the program. It was simple enough. I found out that I was hooked, that I could not go ahead in my life without drinking. But I couldn't go to Alcoholics Anonymous. It was one of those things impossible for me, and I will tell you why. I lived in a town of less than 3,000 people. I would have about as much anonymity as the water tower. And I had tried always to be a good mother. We have two sons and two daughters. I had been the PTA bit, and I was a room mother for all of them, and I taught Sunday school for years, you know, did everything that I thought a mother was supposed to do. And I think I was a good mother. And people thought of me as a lady. And here I was going to have to break my anonymity if I came into AA. Another thing was we had moved to this town. We're in the Bible Belt, and we have more churches than anything else, I believe, in that town. At any rate, when we moved to Nakona, they had had a big argument because they had built a swimming pool in the town, and it was split wide open, this argument. I'd never heard of mixed bathing, but that was the issue. And if you don't know what mixed bathing is, I didn't. It's when men and women go in the swimming pool at the same time. Well, I thought, you know, my gosh, if that's how they feel about mixed bathing, why would they think of a woman alcoholic? You know, it just scares me to death to think of it. So I couldn't possibly go. And then another thing was, as I've told you about, I was thought of as a lady, and I have this false pride. And I think you die. I think a lot of people probably have died of false pride rather than admit their alcoholism. Anyway, that's why it was out of the question for me to go to AA. And on top of all this, I was Dr. Bob's daughter-in-law. Of course, he had been dead for 29 years, and my dad had been dead almost that long. But, you know, I thought, well, you know, it would sort of dishonor their memory for, you know, all these reasons. Well, I quit drinking cold turkey. I'm very grateful that our first meeting in Nakona is the date of my sobriety. I just quit cold turkey, and if you've ever done that, you know what I'm talking about. I woke up at 4:30 the next morning, and I thought, you have done some dumb things in your life, but this takes the cake. There is no way you can go 24 hours without drinking, because by this time, I was drinking day and night. I wasn't down on the main street falling down, but my body demanded that I have a drink every couple of hours. I no longer drank for the result, because I knew nothing good was going to come of a drink. I just drank to fulfill my physical need. And I thought, shoot, 24 hours at a time, that's all you have to go, they said. And I thought, well, what an order. I can't go through with that. You know, to me, the word I identify with alcoholism is insidious. That's the way it happened to me. It just seemed like it just snuck up on me, just gradually. I felt like it entered our house a guest, and then it became the host, and then it became the master. And I remember the terrible feeling I had the day that I thought, I've passed the point of no return. I can't back up. I'm never going to get better. I'm only going to get worse. Well, of course, you'd think that was when I went through the doors to Alcoholics Anonymous, and it wasn't. The first thing I decided to do was to keep my home as nicely as I could and to keep myself as well-groomed as I possibly could, because I wanted so much for the outside to belie what was going on the inside. That was my goal, and to me, that is a total lack of spiritual integrity when the outside tries to hide what's going on in the inside, and that was my goal. I always had a horror of being thought of as a drunken slob, and I was going to do anything in my power to dispel that notion to everybody. Well, you know, our good big book talks about incomprehensible demoralization. And those two words define what I came to before I surrendered and lost all my pride and came into the program. Well, one thing I do know, if we suppress pain and abandon reality, we will pay the price in another anguish. And if you're in AA, you know exactly what I'm talking about. It has not been too long ago that I heard a talk that Bill Wilson made the day of Dr. Bob's death, November the 16th. And I want to share something about that with you, because it's news to me. And Bill said he and Dr. Bob went to call on Bill Dodson. And after they had talked to him for a while, Bill Dodson said, I'm sorry, but you have come to me too late. My life is just about over, and I'm going to check in. When I get out of this hospital, I'm going to check into a sanitarium and spend the rest of my life there, because I am beyond help now. And So I try to help someone who's not as far gone. I've lost everything. He did still have his wife, but he said, try to help someone where it'll do some good, etc. And so the two men left, and some days passed, and they reappeared. I don't know how long it was, but it might have been even the next day. And Bill Dodson said, it was not an hallucination. I was not having the DTs or some way off dream. This really happened. These two men actually did come to see me. And his mind had begun to clear up enough. And as you know, that was the man, the first man that they helped successfully. And it's a beautiful story because you're never too far gone. It's never too late to reclaim your life and be saved. And I just love the story. I'll tell you that one of the things I used to do when I drank, when I got bad about drinking, I never worried about where the bottle kept going down because I just went over to the kitchen sink and filled it up with water. And I bought real cheap booze, and Bob would take a drink of it, and he'd say, you know, I know this T.W. Samuels is about as cheap as you can buy, but it is so smooth. And it was by that time. And one time we were in France, and he said, let's buy a bottle of Pernod. I said, well, what's that? And he said, it's a liqueur. It tastes sort of like licorice. And I said, okay. As long as it wasn't beer, I didn't care for beer. To me, beer was sort of a staple, like flour and sugar, and I didn't like to drink it. I couldn't get a buzz out of it. But when he said it's a liqueur, I said, well, great. So we got the bottle of Pernod, went up to the hotel room, and he set the bottle down on the table, and he went into the bathroom. Well, he'd punched my button when he did that. I rushed over, I got the top off that bottle as fast as I could, and I took two or three straight gulps, whatever I thought I had time for. And now, Pernod looks a lot like bourbon. Anyway, I rushed over to the sink in the hotel room and filled it up with water. And as soon as the water hit the liqueur, it turned milky. This had never happened to me before, and I thought, what am I going to do? What possible thing can I say? And he walked out and took one look at that, and he said, Betty, did you put water in that Pernod? And I looked him straight in the eyeballs, and I said, why, no. And to this day, I've never thought of a better answer. I never have. I can't think of a logical answer that could be believed. I remember, of course, there are many sad things that happened, but I remember one thing that I can chuckle about now. I went into the little drugstore in our little town, and I'd see these bottles of desiccated liver tablets. And I'd study on that, and of course, I couldn't discuss this with anyone. And I'd think, I wonder if my liver is desiccated or if it ought to be desiccated. And I didn't know whether it'd be good for me or bad for me. And I certainly couldn't ask the pharmacist, and I wasn't going to ask Bob. I didn't want him to know I was that hooked. And I never knew what to do about it, so I never did buy any desiccated liver tablets. Anyway, when I came in, there was this pharmacist that came in, and one of the first questions I asked him was, what? Tell me what desiccated liver tablets are. And he looked at me and said, I don't know. So, I don't know yet to this day, but I guess it might help. You know, we say that alcohol is cunning, baffling, and powerful. And I always said, and patient. It's very patient. It will wait for you always. It is dormant inside our bodies if we are alcoholic. It will always be there. And just like the color of our eyes. I mean, if you put on contact lenses and had green eyes, you still have brown eyes underneath it. And we still always have this within us as long as we live. And I've seen people get overconfident in this program. I've been to funerals. in the almost 16 years I've been in here, and I'm sure you've been to funerals too, for people who got overconfident. And we must never let that happen. It's a death sentence. Overconfidence can be a real killer. As a matter of fact, one of my friends, General Custer, told me that. And it's quite true. We want to always remember, the person I was will drink again. If I don't stay close to this program and go to my meetings and listen to you and the troubles you're having and how you're overcoming them, etc., etc., I will gradually become again the person I used to be. And that person will drink again. So I must not let that happen. Well, the phone rang one day, and I was so desperately, desperately depressed. And this man said, "Betty, they're going to start a program in Nakona for people who have a problem like we do. Would you come?" And I started crying, and I said, "Yes, I'll come." By this time, my false pride is gone, and if I'd had to go on my hands and knees, I would have done it. I was at the point of total surrender. I went to that meeting that night, and when I woke up at 4:30 the next morning, I thought, "Boy, you have really blown it this time. You couldn't go 24 hours, as I've said." But somehow I did, and I know now that God was doing for me what I could not have done for myself, because my body was crying out for alcohol, desperately needing alcohol. And it just happened that I did not have a sweet Al-Anon waiting in the wings for me. My husband did not want me to go into AA. All he wanted was for me to drink reasonably. And he kept telling me that. And he never asked me to stop drinking, just drink reasonably. And I think that's sensible. Of course, I'll do that. You don't always meant to, but it never worked out that way. And before, you see, my father was an alcoholic. Bob's father, as you know, was an alcoholic. And yet you would have thought neither one of us had ever heard of alcoholism. Drink reasonably. Fail every time. Well, anyway, he was not ready for the party to be over, and he was pretty hostile about the whole thing. In fact, he said to me one day, "I'll tell you one thing. As far as this program goes, you stand alone." Oh, it just, you know, just broke my heart. But I must hasten to tell you that we were blundering our way through, both of us, and doing the best that we could. My husband, and oh, of course, I couldn't ask him to stop drinking. He was a very enthusiastic drinker, and we were drinking partners. But about 2 or 3 months after I quit, he decided on his own that he would be better off if he stopped drinking. And I can testify that that was true. And he quit, and he has been my greatest supporter and booster, has been a wonderful Al-Anon, has helped me in every conceivable way. And so every day, I didn't know whether I'd make it another day or not, but I would make it one day at a time. And one day I said to him, "I don't know. I know one day I'll start to feel better physically, spiritually, and emotionally. But if it doesn't hurry up and happen, I'm not going to make it, because I'm just hanging on by a thread." I would go in a walk-in closet and close the door and just want to beat my head against the wall. It was just that horrible. I don't go around recommending it. But I'll tell you one good thing I got out of it. We have 2 sons and 2 daughters, and any time a crisis would come, living problems that we all have, and I'd think, oh, for the relief of a drink. But you had told me nothing is ever so bad but what taking a drink will make it worse. Not instantly, but almost instantly. And I'd think if it got worse, I couldn't stand it. And we know that alcohol is a depressant, and I think I couldn't stand it if I got more depressed over this situation. And so, you see, I had such trouble in my withdrawal that I thought if I drank again, I could never withdraw again. I felt God used up all his help doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. in that time when I sobered up. And so I hung in there with his help and did stay sober. Now, when I went in, I knew I've always been very vulnerable. And I don't know why, because I was raised in a happy family. I really was. We went on picnics. We had lots of fun. And when I was going to school, a lot of honors came to me. So I didn't have any terrible memories, you know. I had no way of thinking of myself as a victim, no excuse whatsoever, because I'd had a good life. And so there was no excuse in my own mind for myself being an alcoholic. But anyway, when I came in, I thought, I'm going to write to those people near and dear to me and tell them I'm going into AA. The farther I have my neck stuck out, the harder it will be for me to drink again. So I did write to these people. But everybody I wrote to, I said, please don't tell Lois Wilson. Lois Wilson must never find out that I'm an alcoholic, because I knew that that would be the last straw for her. When I met Bob's mother and father the first time, my father at that time was having a drinking problem. I wouldn't have dreamed of telling him that he had a drinking problem. In fact, I had never heard the words Alcoholics Anonymous till we went to this first meeting. And I thought, it was before our marriage, and this dentist from Cleveland got up to talk. Mom and Dad were talking about going to this meeting at King's School. I had the slightest idea what it was. Bob had never mentioned Alcoholics Anonymous. And I sat there and I thought, my gosh, I didn't know there was a solution, and this dentist is a living example of the solution. I got so excited. I was so elated after that meeting. I rushed up and I said to Dr. Bob, oh, you must be so proud to have co-founded such a fellowship as this. And I'm telling you, I had said the wrong thing. He said, no, never proud. I have only been used as an instrument. I'm just an agent. And he never wanted that put upon him. He never wanted to be put upon a pedestal. And so I never made that mistake again. But anyway, I went home, and I'll try to make the story short, because I do want Geneva to have time to say something after I finish. But I took my father to a drying out place, and we didn't have any $10,000. We didn't have any $5,000 to spend on a drying out place. But there was this little sanitarium, and I went to in Denver, and I went the next morning, and I said, Dad, what kind of a night did you have? And he said, terrible, people running up and down the aisle screaming and so on. And he said, they took my money and everything. And I realized I had inadvertently committed him to an insane asylum. And I thought, oh, he'll never believe this was an accident. And I said, I'm so sorry. And you get your things together and I'll take you out of this. Because Mother and I adored my father. He was a deeply spiritual man, had a fantastic sense of humor, and was just loads of fun to be around. And I said, we'll pack your things and I'll get you out of here. And he said, this was like 8 o'clock in the morning. And he said, Betty, two AAs have already come to see me and talk to me. And I'm going to stay and I'm going to be all right. And I want to tell you, those two AAs don't know how that 12-step turned out. But I want to tell you that my father and another man started the first AA group in New Mexico. And those two men that made that 12-step call never knew how that their call turned out. We don't know what's going to happen. And to this day, I bless those two men that came to see my father, because not knowing any better, I would have taken him out of there and taken him home if they hadn't been to see him. So many wonderful things have happened. Now, the first man that helped me happened to be this pharmacist I spoke of. And instead of having almost 16 years, as I do, he's had some slips. Now, as I say, I haven't had any slips, and it's not because I'm so great. It's simply because I don't think I could ever sober up again. Anyway, John has had his problems, but now he's celebrating like 4 years of sobriety. But he told me, he would come by and take me to the meetings, and he told me later that he was not drinking, but he was into a bunch of stuff he shouldn't have been in. Well, I didn't know it, and he helped me so much. I'll always be grateful to him. And I heard Sister B talk one time, and she said, you know, God can use a crooked pencil to draw a straight line. And he doesn't care who he uses when he wants to make a point. And I have a deep debt of gratitude to John. And he has done a wonderful, wonderful job in helping so many people that all of us in AA in Nakona owe him, John, an awful lot. Well, I want to share with you, when I found out, you know, I said to everybody, please don't tell Lois Wilson. I thought people, you know, were just going to mark my name off. I was just going to be canceled out if many people knew I was in AA. Well, I kept telling people, don't tell Lois. I thought, oh my God, I'm going to have to write and tell Lois myself. No help for it. So I wrote Lois, and I don't know what I said, but I got, this was March the 13th of 79, and I don't know how long it was before I wrote her, but in April 15th, the next month, I got a letter back from her. This is the first time I've ever shared this, and she said, this is just part of the letter. She said, what a surprise to learn of your experience, both tragic and glorious. I am so glad you are in AA. It is another tie to bring us closer together. And she said, her book, Lois Remembers, there are about 3,000 copies, and we cannot distribute them yet because of the strike that is on in 1979. And she wrote me a beautiful letter. And, you know, instead of people turning against you, they turn towards you and try to help you. After my father sobered up, well, when my father died, the one most wonderful thing that was said to me, someone came up to me and said, Betty, he is alive today. In the hearts of hundreds of people, he has counseled. And so it had a happy ending. The story had a happy ending. And my father did help an awful lot of people. Anyway, after he came into the program, he wrote a letter to Dr. Bob, and I've never shared this either. But on January the 6th of 1945, I'm going to quote from a little bit of his letter. He said, my dear Anderson, I was delighted to receive your letter, literary masterpiece, but feel quite incapable of replying in kind. However regrettable this may be, I can at least express my happiness in the knowledge that you too have been helped by taking advantage of the basic spiritual truths that we have all found so useful and sustaining. Our members of approximately 5,000 would indicate that their merit has long since passed the experimental or speculation stage. It is a great source of happiness to me. It's a great source of satisfaction to me to feel that I have, in my small way, contributed something and received the sum total of happiness in the world. I feel absolutely that that is one reason for our being here at all. We are thrilled to all hear how happy the kids are. We do what we can toward making their home very comfortable. You and Mrs. Anderson can come visit at our mutual convenience, and please do so. And I want to add, you know, when he says we moved to a suburb of Cleveland, so we were close to his parents, and that was a great blessing. I love those people as my own parents, and that was how they loved me. We just shared so many things. They had books that my parents had. We'd read a lot of the same things, you know, like Daily Strength for Daily Needs. Both of our parents had that beautiful little daily meditation. And The Greatest Thing in the World by Henry Drummond, which emphasizes the 13th chapter of Corinthians. That was also a mutual thing. We had a lot of things to talk about and to share. But I do want to say one thing. He says, we do whatever we can toward making their home very comfortable. Well, one day, we had no money at all, and they had very little. But one day, Dad showed up with this beautiful couch, and it was covered in mahogany and gold silk. Beautiful thing. And Bob and I were young and dumb, and we wanted sectional furniture, so he sawed it in two. And, of course, ruining the material at the same time. Can you believe it? If my kids had done that, I think I'd have throttled them. But anyway, I want you to know Mom and Dad never acted like they even noticed it. I don't know how they had the self-control. Bob had to put additional legs on it when he sawed it in two, and we had to recover it. And he said, I picked out some material that looked like mattress ticking. That's not true. It looked more like awning material. It's two shades of blue and huge stripes, you know. And they never said a word to us. They were just wonderful. But we had so much fun together, so many laughs. And they were a joy to be around. And then after we moved from there and moved to New Mexico, this was my husband's idea, not mine, but he became a transplanted Yankee. And he transplanted to the Southwest very easily. And they came to see us, and we had a wonderful, loving relationship. I will always be a blessing in my life. And as I say, I want to cut this short. I have fallen and hurt myself, not seriously, but anyway, uncomfortably. And I do want to have Geneva visit with you a minute, but in closing, I want to share with you a little poem my father sent me, and the last lines of it remind me of AA and the founders. And it was this: it is not what we add to the temple past, but only how well we can hold it fast, how grateful we can keep it green. And isn't that true? If we can just keep our program green, we're all right. We've got it made. I believe God has his own big book. And in it, I quote, he said, I will give you a new heart and a new spirit I will put within you. And that's what he's done in AA. You know, they say you can't change human nature. But that's not true. You know, Saul, who hated, became a Paul, who loved. A worldly Magdalene became a spiritual Magdalene. And you know, we are all of us miracles, whether we be in Al-Anon or whether we be in AA or even in Alateen. And thank you for listening to me.